Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It is Wednesday, February 7th, and this is, we're about to call the second case of four on our calendar for today. I am Judge Wheelock, and I'm on a panel today with Judges Sleater and Schmidt, and we're in courtroom 100. As you may know, our oral arguments are recorded by the court, and they're available on the court's website within 24 hours. And I will have the marshal formally call the next case.
Now calling A231264, EDFRE U.S. Development LLC Appellant versus RES America Construction, Inc. Respondent.
And counsel, as you probably know, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument. Counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The center podium may be adjusted up and down for your comfort, and there is a clock on there that will show you your time. So when you begin, please introduce yourself, identify the name of your client, let us know of any pronunciations or pronouns. And I believe with that, counsel, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. Hugh Brown from Fabianski, Wester, Hart, and Thompson, appearing on behalf of appellant. It is established black letter law that a claim rejected as premature does not trigger res judicata and may be reasserted when no longer premature. That black letter law resolves this appeal in EDF's favor. EDF's claim for damages in the prior case was dismissed as premature because EDF did not send an invoice before bringing that action. When this court agreed with the district court that the invoice was a condition to recovery, EDF took the necessary action, sent the invoice, and reasserted its claim.
Mr. Brown, can I ask you, because you led off with an overarching question I do have, as I do get the impression, your characterization of error as to both element one and three of the res judicata is just what you said now. You characterize the court's order as a dismissal due to a condition precedent, and he used the word premature, which you can see the language of premature is used in the order. And I want you to help me explain how I didn't see the order that way, but let me ask it maybe from a different angle. Is it true? I did not see any cases that you cited on the issue of a condition precedent or the secondary sources involve a case like here. Number one, it had a trial through all the merits. And number two, did not conclude that the breach itself was premature, because here it seems like there's no dispute there was a breach. And it was only the damages, the remedy, for which there was a condition precedent. Would you agree, number one, there's no authority for the proposition that a trial through the merits, nevertheless, is similar to a dismissal on the pleadings as premature because of a condition precedent?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would not. There are cases that we cite in both our opening brief and our reply where the rule that we are advocating did apply, and there was a trial on the merits. I believe the Badra case involved a trial on the merits. I believe the Torinas case involved a trial on the merits, and I believe the Garbush case involved a trial on the merits.
Now, the Torinas case, that's the Wisconsin interesting factual scenario in 1881. That was not a condition precedent, correct? Well, the Wisconsin legislature passed a law, as I recall, after the first trial, which then authorized the offering of credit, which then that was a fact out of the control of all the parties.
It was not what we might traditionally describe as a condition precedent case, but it was a case involving a precondition to bringing suit. In that sense, I think it's functionally instructive on the issue that we're dealing with here.
Well, the big picture question, I guess, and if you could answer this for me, is it not true the cases that are dismissed because of a condition precedent go to the element of breach, meaning there cannot be a breach until the condition for which would lead to a potential breach actually had occurred, but I didn't see any case relate to a damages issue which we have here. Do you see that distinction?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that that's a distinction that any of the cases rely on. And also, I would point out that to bring a case for breach of contract, damages is a necessary element of a breach of contract case. So I think that whether the condition precedent is a necessity to claim a breach of the contract or to claim damages for breach of contract, it ends up in the same place. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
But just to clarify, there's no case that you can point me to where there was a case on the merit similar to what we have here, and I realize it's unique, but the Hornbook or black letter laws you talk about, it generally, I say, goes to breach because they use the phrase that it's premature to bring an action for breach of contract because of lack of evidence. And so the Florida case, for instance, you cited was a notice provision, as I recall, under their foreclosure statutes, and so it was dismissed on the pleadings. So in other words, there had not, like here, I was just curious if there was one case similar to this where a case had been tried on all of its merits and a breach is found, which it was here, damages were allowed for the invoiced portions and denied because of the condition preceding for the non-invoiced ones.
There aren't cases involving this exact fact pattern involving an invoice, but there are cases that involve a trial on the merits, and I also I don't see a distinction in the case law that we've cited in our brief which would hinge on that, on the procedural stage at which the case is decided.
Counsel, it seems to me that the first lawsuit dealt with whether invoices were necessary at all. That was a big part of the first lawsuit in terms of the legal theory and arguments made to this court that invoices aren't necessary, or alternatively, that the complaint and the demand said was functionally an invoice such that the condition precedent was met. So given if that recitation is correct, why is this not barred because this is a claim that could have been litigated in that first lawsuit?
Two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, I don't think the recitation is accurate. The condition precedent issue did not come up until 6 weeks before trial started. That was a year and a half after the case was sued out. Lots of depositions had been taken, lots of discovery had been done, two motions for summary judgment and decided. This was not a big issue for most of the case. It came up in a motion in limine to dismiss one of our expert reports. The court didn't rule on that motion until after trial. And that, of course, wasn't confirmed by this court until the appeal, and at that point we did send the invoice. So I would reject Rez's characterization of this as a big central issue in the first case. It simply wasn't. Second, this issue was not and could not have been decided in the first case because a necessary factual predicate to this issue, the invoice, did not exist. The issue in the previous case was whether an invoice was necessary and whether our letter or our complaint satisfied that requirement. The issue here was whether the invoice that we submitted in January 2023 complied with that invoice or complied with that requirement. The issues have, of course, evidence in common, facts in common, but they're not the same. The district court relied in part on...
Can I just follow up, Bill, on that comment?
Yes, of course.
The reason the invoice didn't exist is because your client didn't send the invoice. In other words, in answer to Judge Smith's question, it could have been, and I think you conceded that to the trial court, and your client either chose or inadvertently, or who knows what, did not send it. So, again, isn't that a pretty big distinction from, again, some of the cases, including the Wisconsin Torinius case, where a change in circumstances or law completely out of the hands of the party changes the facts on the ground, whereas here the only fact that's changed is your client's choice not to send an invoice and then to send an invoice.
I don't think so, Your Honor. In the initial case, This wasn't an issue until 6 weeks before trial. EDF had no idea that even Rez thought that an invoice was a condition precedent. We certainly didn't read the contract that way. As far as EDF was concerned, there wasn't a condition precedent that we were not satisfying. It isn't as though we saw this invoice requirement, made an intentional choice not to comply with it, and trusted to luck. This was not an issue until right before trial. Second, I don't see any meaningful distinction between EDF's omission of an invoice and the bank's omission of a contractually correct acceleration notice in, for example, the Badra or the PNC case. To my mind, those are completely analogous. In both cases, they were technically within the control of the party whose responsibility it was to perform the condition precedent. In both cases, it was not done for one reason or another. And in both cases, the party who initially inadvertently failed to comply with the condition precedent was allowed to go back and do it once the requirement of the condition precedent had been established or once the condition precedent had been performed.
You've referenced a couple of times that this didn't become an issue after years of litigation until about 6 weeks before trial.
Correct.
But then it was an issue at trial, and it certainly was an issue on appeal, right?
That is true. At that point, we were 6 weeks from trial. The court had not ruled. We strongly disagreed with Rez's argument that the invoice was a condition precedent. We simply didn't think it was the case. Also, to, I suppose, prophylactically accede to Rez's position, we would have sacrificed a year and a half of prejudgment interest. We had good faith reasons for not sending the invoice at that point, and good pragmatic reasons for not doing it as well. And again, the trial court did not rule on this issue until after trial. So it wasn't until that point that we had any inkling that the court agreed with Rez.
But at that point, like the 6 weeks before trial, you could have said, okay, this is maybe a problem. Let's move to continue the trial to go reopen depositions or talk about this particular provision of the contract or send the invoice.
The Druitt's case tells us that we were under no obligation to do that. The Druitt's case tells us that res judicata is measured as of the date the complaint in the initial action is filed. Facts which exist as of that date cannot be relitigated under res judicata. Facts which post-date that complaint, unless there's a supplemental complaint or something like that, can. And the Druitt's case is also very clear that there is no obligation to submit a supplemental complaint. So even if one might think, and I know Rez does, think that we should have submitted an invoice at that point, it would have had no effect on the application of res judicata, and the district court's decision would still be in error. In the time I have left, I want to touch on a couple points briefly. I want this court to think about what would happen if the district court case is affirmed. Every time a plaintiff were to miss a condition precedent to a contract but proceed to trial in the good faith belief that the condition does not exist or that they had properly fulfilled the condition, they'd be barred forever from collecting on their contract. Banks would be potentially barred from collecting loan principal. That can't be and isn't the law. Banks in particular, I think, would have a major shock to the system if the law that the district court, the rule that the district court applied, were the rule. All the cases we cite say that that's not how res judicata should be applied. And if the trial court is not overturned, the case would excuse all sorts of valid substantive claims due to a procedural mistake, not providing notice or an invoice before suit is initiated. Sorry, I want to jump ahead. Rez and the district court raised the concern that to affirm would be to invite endless litigation. That certainly isn't the case. A litigant has no incentive to deliberately ignore a condition precedent. That's because in a new case, a party would be bound by the conclusions from the first action on every element of the claim except for the condition precedent element. I, as a party, cannot relitigate offer or acceptance, consideration, interpretation, breach, or damages. The only thing I can relitigate is the fulfillment or not of the condition precedent. The idea that any litigant would deliberately botch the condition precedent in order to gain no more than a chance of spending another couple years and tens of thousands of dollars relitigating that issue makes absolutely no sense. We don't think that's a concern. And I want to end by reminding the court what's at stake here given the broader background of this case. Res has worked hard to portray itself as the aggrieved party here, but it's undisputed from the prior litigation that Res completed a large construction project inexcusably late, that EDF suffered millions of dollars of damages because Res was late, and that EDF had a valid and enforceable liquidated damages clause to compensate it when Res was late. The only reason that Res has not had to pay that money is because EDF didn't send invoices that it knew Res disputed and would reject. And the factual basis for that is set out in our briefing. Res has avoided a $5.6 million debt based on a technicality. It's grasping for some rule that would establish that EDF has one chance and one chance only to fulfill its condition precedent, but the black letter law, the decisions in our brief show that that's not the case, and the commercial implications of such a rule would be devastating. So for these reasons, we ask that you reverse the district court's order dismissing the complaint and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So we will turn to counsel for the respondent next. Again, there are 15 minutes on the clock. Feel free to adjust the podium as needed and begin when you are ready.
Good morning. Jim Hartnett, Fagery, Drinker, Biddle, and Reith on behalf of respondent. May it please the court. This case is about a failure of proof at trial and nothing more. And the legal principle that should be validated here is that a plaintiff gets one chance and only one chance to try its case. Where a plaintiff puts a fact at issue, it cannot withhold evidence of which it is aware to prove that fact. If it does, it must live with the result. Here, EDF failed to proffer an additional invoice in the prior case, even though it admits that it could have done so. That strategic decision bars this wasteful second lawsuit, and the district court's dismissal should be affirmed. That EDF's failure of proof relates to its satisfaction of a contractual invoice requirement for liquidated damages does not make this a special case that entitles it to start a second lawsuit after having already subjected Res to 3 years of litigation, a two-week trial, hundreds of pages of briefing, and a prior appeal. This case is about a failure of proof because EDF chose to make it about that by setting out to prove at trial that it satisfied the contractual LD invoice requirement and then selectively deciding what proof to present. That choice is binding, and it distinguishes this case from all the cases EDF cites where a party never got to trial because it failed to satisfy a condition precedent. In the prior case, EDF pled both the existence of and satisfaction of the contractual invoice requirement. Mr. Brown's suggestion that this issue came up only 6 weeks before trial simply is not true. I want to point the court to the pleadings, the complaint that EDF filed in that case. And these are two quotes from that complaint. This is EDF's pleading, quote, "Under the EPC agreement, Res is obligated to pay EDF within 7 days after receiving an invoice for liquidated damages incurred." And later in that same complaint, quote, "EDF submitted invoices for liquidated damages and demurrage charges due and owing under the EPC agreement for Res's failure to time the performance work," unquote. EDF pled the existence of the invoice requirement and the satisfaction of the invoice requirement, and then it set out to prove that it, in fact, satisfied the contractual invoice requirement. And again, it wasn't 6 weeks before trial. It was 5 months before trial when the deposition of EDF's damages expert was taken by me, and he was questioned extensively about why there were no invoices to support the liquidated damage claims that he was advancing. That's when it was squarely put at issue to the extent that you could say that their own pleading didn't put it at issue. But regardless, when that deposition was taken 5 months before trial, that witness was examined. Where are the invoices to support these LD claims? And the witness didn't have an answer, which ultimately led to a motion in limine to exclude the testimony. But all of this was done well before the trial even commenced. EDF was plainly on notice of its obligation to satisfy the contractual invoice requirement that it pled, that it satisfied. As the plaintiff, EDF had the ability to make these strategic choices. It could have done in 2020 what it tried to do in January of 2023, send another invoice. It admitted to the district court in this case that it deliberately chose not to pursue its new invoice strategy in the prior case. EDF also could have withdrawn from the prior case the portion of its LD claim for which it lacked invoices, or it could have sought a continuance of the trial pending its effort to further satisfy the invoice requirement. EDF, as the plaintiff, chose not to pursue any of these strategic options. Instead, it stuck to its guns. It insisted at trial that it had fully satisfied the invoice requirement, despite Rez's claim to the contrary, and it put Rez in jeopardy for the full $5.7 million claim for liquidated damages. Here's how EDF framed this proof issue as a point of error in its briefs in the prior appeal. Quote, EDF did invoice Rez the entirety of its LD claim when it sent Rez a letter expressly demanding payment of all liquidated damages on the project on February 8, 2019, unquote. This court affirmed both the district court's rejection of this proof and an award of liquidated damages to EDF. EDF's objection here is only to the amount of liquidated damages that it was awarded in the prior case, nothing more.
I assume you would have to at least acknowledge that, and this is part of the questioning I had for appellant's counsel, that when there is a condition precedent, generally in contractual matters, that becomes an exception. You see that from the case law to res judicata, precisely because until that time comes, then there can't be a breach, which includes breach and damages as well. So what's your best answer in response to that? And I didn't see any case law, but does that mean necessarily that principle that when there's a condition precedent, that it is premature, whether a judge says premature or not?
Well, Your Honor, I think you hit it correctly in your questioning of Mr. Brown when you said, you know, here the condition precedent is not a condition precedent to the commencement of a lawsuit. EDF was entitled to pursue its claim for breach of the EPC contract. This was one damage claim within that lawsuit for which there was a condition precedent to recover the damages that it was seeking. One piece of a damage claim in a much broader lawsuit where there were all sorts of other claims for breach of contract, demurrage claims, there were counterclaims by Rez. This is to take, you know, to compare it, for example, to the banking cases that Mr. Brown posits as the horrible thing that this court shouldn't, this case will disrupt the banking system of the state of Minnesota. You know, those condition precedents are a condition precedent to commencing a foreclosure action. You cannot foreclose if you don't satisfy the notice provisions of the loan agreements. That's not what this case is about. This case is not about whether or not EDF was entitled to commence its breach of contract case lawsuit. This case is about whether or not these particular damages, one segment of these damages, were recoverable because EDF did not send an invoice. And this is mentioned in the prior opinion of this court. You know, there were strategic reasons why EDF did not want to send those invoices. There were reasons why they wanted Rez to work through the winter to get that project completed before the end of 2018. With a promise that if Rez did so, it wasn't going to be assessed all of the LDs. So there were factual issues about why was there an executive meeting? There were two invoices sent before the executive meeting. There was an executive meeting and no invoices sent thereafter. These were factual issues presented at the trial. There were strategic reasons why EDF chose not to attempt to cure the failure of sending these invoices before the trial, during the trial, or after the trial. But EDF, as the plaintiff, is bound by those strategic choices. These are strategic proof choices. There are three reasons why this court should affirm the dismissal of this second lawsuit. The first is collateral estoppel. EDF is collaterally stopped from relitigating the sufficiency of the evidence submitted to prove that it complied with the LD invoice requirement. The second is res judicata. The first and second lawsuits involved the exact same underlying facts, and there was a final adjudication on the merits that was affirmed on appeal. EDF is thus prohibited by res judicata from pursuing this case. And finally, final completion. If you don't want to talk about collateral estoppel or res judicata, the party's contract prohibited EDF from submitting an invoice for previously un-invoiced liquidated damages after final completion of the project. The district court in the prior case found that final completion occurred as of October 24, 2019, and EDF did not appeal that finding. Final completion is an independent basis for affirmance of the result below. Turning quickly to collateral estoppel, there are four elements: an identical issue, a final judgment on the merits, the same parties, and that the estopped party was given a full and fair opportunity to litigate. Really, the only one of those conditions that's in dispute is that EDF claims that the issue is not the same. But respectfully, the issue is precisely the same. This is from EDF's appellate statement of the issues in its prior appeal. Quote, EDF nevertheless did invoice RES for all of its claimed liquidated damages, unquote. That is the issue on which it sought reversal of the district court's rulings in the prior case. There was a full trial on the merits of that issue. There was an appeal of that trial, and a judgment was entered in EDF's favor for the liquidated damages that it proved that it invoiced during the trial. Collateral estoppel prevents EDF from relitigating the extent to which it proved that it invoiced RES for all of its claimed liquidated damages.
Counsel, so even if I want to get to the final completion argument that you just addressed a little bit, even if they had submitted an invoice the 5 months before trial after the expert's deposition, your client's position would have been, well, this is too late.
They had until October 24th, 2019 to submit the invoice. They started the lawsuit in April of 2019. So there was a window of opportunity for them to submit the invoice. And further, had they given the district court in the prior case the opportunity, you know, the district court could have, you know, the district court ultimately determined when final completion occurred. The district court determined the extent to which EDF was entitled to recover its liquidated damages, among many other disputed issues in a 100-page findings of fact and conclusions of law. But if the district court had been given the opportunity to consider whether or not EDF was entitled to present as evidence a new invoice, you know, it's a little bit of speculation as to what the district court would have done if given the chance to actually address the issue squarely. But I would say that given that the district court found that final completion occurred as of October 24th, 2019, there's certainly an argument to say that that was when the window closed. But that was after they commenced their lawsuit. That was after they pled that they had, in fact, invoiced RES for all of their liquidated damages. So the notion that this should have come as a surprise to them, I frankly don't think is a meritorious position.
And the final completion determination made by the district court was made in the first lawsuit in the order after the trial?
Correct. After the full trial on the merits, there were there were lengthy submissions of proposed findings, in fact, of conclusions of order by both parties, hundreds of pages, that which resulted in a order, findings of fact and conclusions of law, that itself was over 100 pages. And as part of that, the district court did two things in that order. The district court awarded liquidated damages to EDF, among awarding EDF many other elements of its claims that it presented and rejecting some, and then rejecting a bunch of RES's claims and awarding RES some compensation. But in a very lengthy order, EDF wins this one, RES wins that one. As part of that, the district court determined when final completion occurred, because that's what the contract required. The contract said that, A, final completion means that all liquidated damages have been paid in full. That's a condition of final completion. And it said, B, if the parties dispute when final completion occurred, then that dispute shall be subject to the dispute resolution provisions of the contract, which in this case was a court trial. So the district court discharged its obligation to resolve that dispute by determining the final completion occurred as of October 24th, 2019. That is a determination that all liquidated damages have been paid in full, and in the very same order, the district court awarded liquidated damages to EDF. So that, respectfully, ends the issue. It precludes the notion that years later, EDF could send another invoice for liquidated damages that that occurred in 2018. I mean, that's another distinguishing factor from the banking law of this state, which, by the way, is governed by the UCC. But setting all of that aside,
can I ask Mr. Hartnett in answer to Judge Schmidt's question? Then the timing of that was that a could that have been was that argued to the district court in addition to res judicata, and whether. By your client for dismissal of the subsequent lawsuit?
We have always maintained that, and it was argued in the prior appeal, that final completion cuts off, well, I guess I would put it this way. Final completion establishes that all liquidated damages have been paid in full. In the prior case and in the prior appeal, it did not even occur to me that that EDF would think that they could send a new invoice after
But in the subsequent lawsuit, was it argued, was that a additional
yes.
argument
Yes,
oh,
in the district court in this case, absolutely. It was preserved by presenting that exact argument to this court. In the district, the dismissal order of the district court in this case, the district court did not address that issue. She issued her ruling on the basis of res judicata and collateral estoppel. But yes, that argument was presented to the district court in this case. I only have a few moments left, so I do want to summarize. Again, EDF, as the plaintiff, they made an intentional decision not to send another invoice. They admitted that fact to the district court in this case. When you decide not to submit a piece of evidence in support of your claim, you cannot come back in a subsequent case and say, oh, now I am going to submit the evidence that I was capable of submitting in the prior case. There is no doubt that EDF was capable of submitting that invoice in the prior case. It was obligated to do so, and its failure to do so results in this court affirming the dismissal of this lawsuit on the basis of either collateral estoppel, res judicata, or final completion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hartnett. And we will turn to counsel for appellant for the last word. There are 5 minutes on the clock. And you can adjust the podium and begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Before I respond to Mr. Hartnett, I want to follow up on my answer to Judge Sleeter from earlier. The American Broadcasting case, the Houston case, the Badra case, and the Garbush case, all cited in our brief, all involved trials on the merits, and all permitted a plaintiff to come back after they had fulfilled a previously absent condition precedent. With respect to the time limit argument that Mr. Hartnett raised, first, we don't think this court needs to get there because the district court did not rule on it. And so if this court declines to if this court agrees with us on the question of res judicata or collateral estoppel, I think the correct thing to do would be to remand the case to the district court to make findings on the EPC contract and whether it contains some sort of time limit for issuance of an invoice. But if the court is inclined to reach that issue now, we've explained in our brief why we think res is misconstruing the EPC contract and its alleged timing requirement for sending an invoice. It contains no such requirement. And we know that's true because the district court in the previous action held that res was liable for liquidated damages after final completion. Therefore, it cannot be the case that a finding of final completion cuts off liability for liquidated damages. I also want to address Mr. Hartnett's assertion that EDF's counsel admitted at oral argument before the district court that previously that evidence could have been issued or submitted during the previous case that was not issued. EDF did not issue this invoice until after the initial case, after this court had ruled on the initial case. This isn't a case where EDF held evidence that already existed and decided to submit it late to get another bite at the apple. EDF took a new action with independent legal significance that satisfied a previously unsupplied condition precedent. That's what makes this case like the cases we cited in our brief, the Badger case, the PNC case, the pages of cases that go EDF's way on this issue.
It seems like this is the appellant or the respondent has some persuasive arguments that this is a change of legal theory. That in the first case, you had a legal theory that invoices weren't necessary, and even if they were, we did invoice them, and you lost. And then now it's a change of legal theory on the exact same facts and issues.
The question, I think, is whether it's only a change in legal theory. A change in legal theory on the same set of facts, you're right, does not defeat res judicata. But where the facts change and a new intervening fact changes the claim, then by necessity the legal theory may be slightly different, but it's not solely a change in legal theory, such as the courts have said, does not take a case out of res judicata. The fact that the elements are different, the claims are different, is dispositive here. Unless the court has questions, that's all I have.
Okay, seeing no other questions, thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
So I just want to say thank you to both counsel for the briefing and the argument here today. It's very helpful to us, and we will take it into consideration. The case is, we take the matter under advisement, and the case is submitted, and we will issue an opinion in the statutory time frame. Thank you.